Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Nan Evans. I'm your Nature Now host for this week, and welcome to a very special Nature Now program. This is part two of a two-part conversation. My guest is Linda Mapes, journalist, nature writer, and author based in Seattle. For the past 27 years, Linda has been an environmental reporter for the Seattle Times, focusing on nature, natural history, native cultures, and government, and the Pacific Northwest Environmental News. This past August, Linda retired from the Seattle Times to put her energies into writing books and long-term environmental reporting, and I, for one, am really looking forward to what she's going to be producing. But before we talk to Linda, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, unlike last week's mystery sound, I've often heard this one. It's a very distinctive call, and you hear it in the Olympic Peninsula woods. And later in today's program, the maker of the song will be revealed, if you haven't figured it out already. And we'll talk a bit about the ethical dilemmas posed by having both of these species in our ecoregion. So now to Linda.
This is a bit of a change in subject, but and I will come back. I wanted you to talk a bit about, in your book, you have some interesting observations about, I sort of characterize it as the tyranny of language, how our language has predisposed us to think of things differently than they are. Mm-hmm. You know, the language of a live tree and a dead tree, you know, you're either alive or you're dead. And if you're dead, you're kind of like dead, nothing there going on. Just briefly, fill that subject in a little bit.
That was some of my most favorite reporting of the whole book. So there's a scientist who I love to work with at Oregon State University. His name is Mark Harmon.
Oh, yeah.
Some people call him Dr. Death. And he has built his entire career on what he calls morticulture, the study
morticulture.
Of dead and down wood. And he and Jerry Franklin are great colleagues. And Jerry describes the process of how they came to understand that dead and down wood were important. So they're standing in an old growth forest at the H.J. Andrews Experimental Forest in Oregon. And literally, Jerry is taking his instruction by what he sees. What does he see in the forest? And he says, you know, there's so much dead and down wood here, it must be important. And beginning to probe that and understand it was revolutionary. People back east.
Yeah, because it's really, how do you even get to the point of asking that question?
Exactly. Yeah. It comes from humility. And mm-hmm. that is one of the things that I love about Jerry Franklin's approach and also Mark's. They're very creative thinkers and they're humble thinkers. They don't think that you just go into a lab and with your bench science come up with some great hypothesis and go out there and, you know, march through a checklist of steps and you're done. They love to be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They love to find out that what they thought was true isn't at all. They love to, if you think you're right, you're probably even wrong about that. So
yeah, which is something we don't often appreciate about science. Is
no,
that what, that's what's real science is
exactly.
to me. It's
pushing the leading edge yeah. of inquiry.
And sometimes you are right and sometimes you're dead wrong.
And when you are, you're beginning to learn something.
Yeah.
So.
And I liked in there you have a quote from Jerry Franklin about asking the question, what am I missing?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow, mm-hmm. what a profound question that is for a scientist to
for
ask.
Anyone.
And for anyone, yes. What am
Especially
I missing?
Especially in this era of braggadocio and blowhards, how mm-hmm. wonderful to hear someone modestly thinking, what could I be missing in this picture? What else do I need to learn?
Yeah.
Who else do I need to talk to? What else do I need to look at? And I just love science presented as an unending, modest, careful inquiry. And mm-hmm. when we talk about dead and down wood, I think one of the things Mark said to me as we were picking apart pieces of rotted wood in the forest was, okay, so you're telling me this is dead, right? Well, there are actually more live cells in this so-called dead tree than there are over there in that so-called live one.
Yeah, so. Rather than, and I thought about for a minute. Well, of course, you know, that is true. If you think about
all the bacteria and the tiny little protozoa and all the little beasties that are chewing and tunneling and grinding and reducing
the
it
cell
eventually.
Structure of a tree isn't very diverse.
Exactly.
It's just, you know, got several different kinds of tissues and there you are.
So I loved learning that. And what was so interesting about their discovery of the importance of this was that ecologically, when a tree quote unquote dies, it's really just beginning its next phase of life. And depending on the species, that could go on for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
First as a standing snag, mm-hmm. where it's a crucial hotel for wildlife. Mm-hmm. And then comes to the ground, and then it's a nurse log for the next generation, gives them that little bit of advantage, just a little higher up off the forest floor, moisture in the log, the seed can sprout. We've all seen those colonnades of trees in a row.
And
you look
logs,
and you see this subtle little, just all that's left from who knows how long ago. Yeah. And there's so much pathos and beauty and poetry in that, you know, this idea of a life continuing on in ways that we don't even fully understand for centuries after. I take great comfort in that. And
that's another profound philosophical perception. Yes,
it's an ecological truth.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of things about this book that, you know, they may sound like these woo-woo ideas, Sam and Forrest. They are actually salmon forests.
They are.
Here in the Pacific Northwest and in New England, where it can still be allowed to happen, you know, the nutrition that these salmon bring back from the sea, where they gain all their body
cycles
size,
through the system,
comes back to the freshwater streams. They come home, they bring themselves as packets of nitrogen and phosphorus, and they are captured by bears and dragged into the woods, and then the ravens eat them, and the birds eat them, and the maggots eat them. Everything eats these carcasses, and that goes into the soil. And then through the mycorrhizal fungi, that pulse of nutrition may travel even further than we knew. I talked to a scientist in BC who talked about the signal of salmon in the trees can be visible from space. That if you look at photographs from satellite imagery of, say, the Adams River in BC in a big salmon year, the trees are actually darker green, brighter green in a big salmon year. You can see it from space. The
so
color
it's the
is different.
Healthy nutrition.
Yes, it's the nitrogen. Exactly. It's like they've been doused with Miracle-Gro. And another scientist told me about how he loves to put on his night vision goggles and go into the forest by the salmon streams and just watch the feast, watch the animals come. And this understanding of how bears are the ones that mediate this nutrient exchange, to me, is very beautiful.
Yeah.
It's the salmon and the trees and the bears and all the other decomposers that are completing this cycle of life. And if you let it, it lasts forever. It's perpetually renewed. It costs nothing. It is one of the most beautiful things you can think about.
Everything's connected to everything else.
It is
else.
So connected.
We know it is, you know, it may be trite, but it is so true.
It is.
And that brings us to think, too, about traditional knowledge. Mm-hmm. The Native Americans got that part.
Right.
You know.
And not surprising, because they lived
in it.
With it and in it and depended on it. If it didn't work out, they couldn't just go to the store. So there were trade networks, of course, but there was no Costco. To the extent that we've become so displaced from and distant from and disconnected from nature, our understanding of it has similarly diminished. But I do think I see a resurgence, a huge resurgence and change in the way science is taught, in the public interest in science and in ecology, especially in our region. But not only, I mean, some of the most hopeful stories that I discovered working back east were with the Appalachian Mountain Club, for heaven's sake. So this is an outdoor club. It's one of the oldest in the country, if not the oldest, and they're across several states. And, you know, they, at this point, are working very hard to come up with a different model of forestry and land preservation so that the two are complementary to one another. And here's how they do it. They raise money to buy land, and they do three things with it. Some of it is set aside for permanent no-touch conservation. Mm-hmm. The trees and the forests just unwind their long stories over time. Other parts of the land that they will buy are used for recreational access, trails, these marvelous ski huts that they're so famous for. They're all about getting outdoors. And then a third part of the landscape will be used for restoration forestry. Now, what do I mean by that? A lot of these forest lands in Maine, especially, were hard used, cut over paper lands. Mm-hmm.
So over and over and over,
over
again.
Over and over again. I mean, Maine used to be the largest producer of pulp and paper in the world. And boy, that's not true anymore. A lot of the towns in New England are just ransacked by these mills that came and went, and there's nothing there anymore but pollution. So many towns, basically from the Canadian border all the way down to the head of tide and in the Penobscot River, are trying desperately to reinvent mm-hmm. themselves. But these paper lands, you know, you don't need a big tree to make pulp. You can cut it as small as you want, and they did, and they do. And so AMC is buying up some of those lands and helping them come back to life, if you will. And the way they're doing that is with selective, barely merchantably large enough thinning. So they'll take teeny stuff, crummy stuff, cut it, chip it, ship it for pulp, and leave the better things mm-hmm. to grow bigger and get better and turn into quality saw logs. This does two things for them. It raises money for the club. They actually mm-hmm. pay taxes. That's a choice. Yeah. They don't have to, but choose to because in rural
New
England.
I know a number of the nonprofit, both land trusts and conservation organizations, who choose to do
that. They do that for the sake of their neighbors. And they don't want neighbors to feel threatened if they acquire property that it
won't.
That's
right.
Same thing for AMC. But I went out with some of the loggers who are working on those lands, and they use different equipment. They use mm-hmm. different techniques, and it's also providing them work.
Yeah.
Working for AMC for restoration forestry was 3/4 of their workload. And so when I think about the Pacific Northwest and what we can do out here, first of all, there are so many acres of these zombie forest lands mm-hmm. that have been hard used, turned into plantations, and they're dark and they're dim and they're dense and there's no food in there. They're basically just dog hair,
right.
and those places need to be reset.
Yeah, and the rotation periods have just shrunk.
Oh,
so they're just
40 years, maybe, which is such a waste of a Doug fir tree, God's greatest hit, and it's being just trashed. It's so
but
sad.
It's really interesting to me, because when I first got sort of exposed to this notion of restoration forestry, mm-hmm. there's a certain knee-jerk there, because we're used to seeing forestry as
Destruction,
right. And the notion that you can do really significant ecosystem conservation and human community building.
Correct.
And forestry.
Correct.
If you do it in a sustainable way.
Correct.
It does take some new technologies, and they're developing.
It's all about how and where, mm-hmm. and it's all in the details. I'm also very chary about these sorts of claims, but I also know that it not only is possible, but I've seen it done. And it's where we're going to have to do a lot more of our work, both to keep people working and to get the forest products we need, and frankly, to bring back to life some of these mm-hmm. zombie forests that we have so altered, they have no hope of ever being a natural forest again. We can't just walk away from them. Now, I am not talking, I would be very clear about this, I'm not talking about mature natural forests that are diverse. And at this point, they are the old growth of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And those are special places. You walk in them and you just know that.
Yeah.
It's like,
and
you know,
they're very different than...
They're not plantations.
Clear, a plantation
forest.
They're
not plantations.
Right.
And I just can't be clear enough about that. And certainly they're not old growth. Old growth, we all know this, is already protected in Washington, Oregon, and in Northern California, thanks to the Northwest Forest Plan. But believe it or not, it's still being cut in BC.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, and
really.
I love the Northwest Forest Plan, and I've always feared that there would come a time, and I think we may be at that time.
Well, this is too bad, because under the Biden administration, the idea was, let's update the Northwest Forest Plan. Why? I mean, it's not perfect. The spotted owls problems had to do with overcutting in the first place, and then the barred owl
overcutting and transportation offshore of a lot of the product that drove the avarice.
And that's why the lawsuits happened that led to the shutdown that led to the Northwest Forest Plan. I mean, that happened for a reason. And now, you know, in comes the Trump administration, and they're now the ones, quote unquote, updating the Northwest Forest Plan. So, you know, that is something to really keep an eye on, because there's a million acres of old growth at stake and much more older forest. And It was and is one of the most ambitious and successful visionary multi-species conservation plans in the world. The
amazing thing. Yeah. There are several calls to action in your book, but I think for me the strongest call to action was the choice of doing nothing is not a choice.
It's totally not a choice. There are too many forests out there at this point that are so degraded and need to be restored, number one. Number two, there are so many forests out there that are not protected that need to be. Mm-hmm. And number three, the thing that nobody ever talks about, you hear about it in the East Coast, but not so much out here, is bugs and disease. And this is linked
to one of the real growing kinds of threats.
I mean, when you're in New England, you're in forests in advanced stages of decay, even in protected areas. Even in protected areas. And this is an environmental crisis people are not familiar with. There are no flames. There are no chainsaws. There are no bulldozers. But you look around.
You can see it, particularly if you're driving from west of the Cascades east.
That's true. You see all the dead trees.
Because you can see a lot of dead trees that are insect damaged.
No, that's real. Yeah. And I think that people are not appreciating the combined link and threat of unchecked global commerce. We do not inspect hardly at all the horticultural products coming into this country, which is almost always the source of these new bugs and diseases. So that's number one, the unchecked invasion of invasive species coming in on commercial products.
Yeah, and a lot of the issues are not native bugs. They're bugs that have come in.
Exactly.
And the trees don't have any natural control on them.
Not at all. And this has been going on since the chestnut blight and the Dutch elm disease. Well, now it's hemlock woolly adelgid. And tragically, we're losing beech trees and birch trees and eastern hemlock. And, it's a sad thing to go into even a protected forest, say in the Adirondacks, as I did. And you see no old beech trees. You don't see them. They're not there. And furthermore, you don't see, the beautiful gloaming of deep, dark hemlocks at the Harvard Forest, where I spent two fellowships writing books about forests. I go into the hemlock grove at the Harvard Forest today. It's bright. And it's bright because the eastern hemlocks have lost all their needles and they're dying and they're falling to the ground. It's still a forest, but what's coming up is this cheerful, young, new, deciduous forest of black birch. It's going to be a different forest. That means different birds. That means different water use. But what a sad thing. And it's all because of, again, nursery stock that came in this case, Japan. And now with the combination with global warming, so you don't have killing winters, these insects are spreading in their range, and so are the diseases. And so you have this unchecked global commerce combined with global warming. We're losing entire species of trees. And there's nothing else that does that, not even logging. I mean, by the time I finished this book, I felt like, to me, now, logging seems like quaint. Honestly, at least it's under our control. We can say yes or no, yes or over here or over there, but this one, not that one. But between these outbreaks of disease and blight and bugs and fire.
And fire.
It's a war out there. Yeah. And look, what are we talking about right now this week in the Olympic Peninsula? But a raging fire. It's now 6 square miles in the Olympic. It's spreading into the Olympic National Park. So these are precious places. And I do have a call to action in this book, which is number one, pay attention, wake up and be involved. It's definitely an all hands on deck locally kind of moment, because the federal government is where it's at, the state government and the local governments, our county governments in our towns. These are the places we can and are making enormous differences.
And it's not just the current administration that makes local involvement so important.
It
goes back to the concept of relationship.
Absolutely.
At the local level.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when I look at what the land trusts are doing, when I look at what the tribes are doing, when I look at what NGOs are doing, community forests, community land trusts, people getting out into the woods and getting rid of endangered species, planting trees, defending, by the way, your urban trees. I live in Seattle, and so I'm very sensitive to the degree to which we're losing these larger side yard trees and street trees. Urban trees are incredibly important. I would say every tree matters, honestly. Yeah. And why is that? Well, because they clean the air, they purify the water, they hold the soil, they're homes for wildlife. And they are critical for our spiritual well-being. Yeah. Everyone has a tree they love. And if they walk by that space and that tree is gone, they've lost something.
There is hope.
Oh, definitely.
There is hope. And we're learning to know what to do. And yes. We're exploring and experimenting with that.
Yes.
The sort of whole notion of, you know, ecological forestry or...
Yes. Invented it.
Yeah.
We're better at this than anybody. We have more people here in the Pacific Northwest who are literally the experts who taught the world about dam removal, about ecological forestry. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got this.
Yes.
And it's just a question of funding, for one, and also commitment and involvement. And I think that when it comes to despair, we all have those moments. I certainly do too. Yeah. But I don't keep a chair for it. I do not feed it from my plate.
Well, it's so enervating. It just...
What's the point?
Yeah.
It's not helpful.
And you can't do anything. You get yourself in a funk.
It's
and
indulgent.
You go down this horrible spiral.
Yeah.
And it's,
and
you know,
affect everyone around you negatively. And you're... What good are you doing?
Yeah.
And so... Don't go there. Why? It feels awful and it does nothing. So.
Just like on the other end, blind hopefulness.
Right. Hope is not a plan.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's equally destructive, but there are things we can
do.
So many. There are things we can do in our own lives.
I'm really glad you brought this up. This is a sensitive subject.
I live in a wood house.
Yeah.
I use a lot of wood things.
But I mean, even in some mainline environmental groups, it's a sensitive subject. They got board members with three houses, right?
So right.
This thing about big consumption. I'm old enough to remember, Nan, small is beautiful.
Right. Oh, yes.
Whatever happened to that?
Yeah.
And man, I think since the 80s, there's been this orgy of consumption and spending and bigger and more. And it's despairing. It doesn't make you happy. It's not good for the planet. Mm-hmm. Save your money and give it away.
Yeah.
It'll make you feel better.
I mean, there's some just sort of dead easy things you can do.
Oh, yeah, like shop at Goodwill.
Yeah.
For instance.
And
buy nothing groups. There are million solutions.
In our household, I think we have bought one roll of paper towels in the last probably close to 10 years.
That's beautiful. And
we use rags.
Yes. Like your grandmother did.
Like your grandmother did. And goodness gracious, we have lots of rags around because things wear out, you know.
They should.
Or bamboo paper towels.
Yeah.
There was just a knock on the door. We're
at time.
And we have talked here a lot.
We'll stop. But it was great fun.
It was great fun. We could do more of this too. So.
Anytime.
Thank you again
so
much for making time for Nature Now.
Thank you, Nan.
Thank you.
Well, that was a fascinating conversation with Linda. She's a fascinating person to talk to, and we could talk actually for quite a long time. But we're running out of time, so a couple of quick updates. I recorded this conversation with Linda Mapes in early August, and the program is airing in early September. In that time, the Bear Gulch fire northwest of Hoodsport that Linda mentioned in our conversation has grown from 4,000 acres to over 10,000 acres. And the fire is about 9% contained. Like many other wildfires, it's not the firefighting objective. Rather, the firefighting agencies strive to protect human life and structures. The next quick update, the local Natural History Society book club is reading Linda Mapes' book, The Trees Are Speaking, for the month of November. Anyone is welcome to join the book discussion. It'll be on Monday, November 24th on Zoom. Check out the Natural History Society webpage at www.olympicnature.org for more information. Or you can go to the Jefferson Land Trust website and wind your way through to find the Natural History Society. And on point to some of the things I talked to Linda about, here on the Olympic Peninsula, we have the opportunity to celebrate the opening of the Chimicum Ridge Community Forest. The grand opening is on Saturday, September 27th, from noon to 4 p.m. Check out the Jefferson Land Trust website, which is www.saveland.org, for more information about the opening and about the goals of this community-managed and valued forest. So now let's go to the mystery sound. In part one, the mystery sound was the call of a northern spotted owl. It's a four-note call. Let's listen to that song again. In the 1990s, the spotted owl, or the northern spotted owl, was catapulted into the spotlight over logging debates in the Pacific Northwest and became a real symbol of the treasured old-growth forest ecosystem. It's a large brown-eyed owl, and it's a key component of mature forests in the West. Ranging from British Columbia to Washington, but in the giant old-growth forests. At night, it silently hunts mammals. Its favorites are wood rats and flying squirrels. And despite the federal protection that began in 1990 when the owls were listed under the Threatened and Endangered Species Act, the spotted owl is actually still declining in the Northwest due to habitat loss, fragmentation, climate change, and competition with barred owls. Hence, this week's mystery sound. Let's hear it again. That is the characteristic call of the barred owl. And it's got a great mnemonic for the call. It's, who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? Well, barred owls are similar in size and appearance to northern spotted owls, but they are invasive to the Pacific Northwest. They've hopscotched their way across the continent from the east, and they are scrappy critters. Some folks joke that they are flying coyotes, eating almost anything that moves, with an aggressive personality. Smaller home ranges are needed than those that are needed by the spotted owl, and the barred owls are very prolific breeders. So the barred owls actually outcompete the native spotted owls in almost every way, and they are outnumbering the spotted owls. And it's actually one of the major reasons for the decline of spotted owl populations. So hence the dilemma. We humans created this problem through our forestry practices, our greedy demand for wood and wood products. And now the question is, what is our responsibility to alleviate the problem? What are the moral, ethical, and humane responses? Well, a year ago or so, was July or August of 2024, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued its final barred owl management strategy. This controversial plan aims to kill over 450,000 individual barred owls across Washington, Oregon, and California. And it began this past spring in the year 2025. So I invite you to ponder this dilemma, educate yourself on the issues, and think critically about the path forward. Ask yourself questions like, do barred owls have their own right to live? How do we weigh compassion and species conservation in this kind of a situation? And since we as humans created this problem, do we have a responsibility to become involved to solve it? Or can we just let what happens happen? In addition to a heartfelt thank you to Linda Mapes, thanks to Nora Petrich, our sound engineer and editor, and thanks to the Cornell Laboratory for permission to use the birdsong recordings from the Macaulay Library. Thanks for listening.